Plotting for Perfection by Tim Prossel, read by the author. The image looking back was my own. Despite the deeper wrinkles, looser jowls, and thinner hair of some 40 or 50 years, my heart pounded in the same way that Dorian Gray's must have when he saw his own aging portrait. The supernatural had nothing to do with this picture, though. It was hard fact, a scientific experiment done with unretouched photography. I sensed something important missing. Oh yes, I reminded myself, breathing is healthy. My hand trembling, I moved the picture to the fixing solution. There was writing, too. A note must have been placed beside the original picture, then another close-up shot taken of them both. The words were too small to read in the red light of my darkroom. In a minute, I ran the wet photo to the lights of my office. The note said, "My biggest regret is that I didn't follow Linda. How would things have been different? Instead, we marry Beth." The handwriting was meticulous, downright monastic. Only then did I see why people teased me about it. I sat down at my desk, almost missing the chair. I stared at the message. "We" to mean one person, and the present tense of "marry" for an act both past and future, showed that a new grammar would have to be worked out. Far more pressing was the message itself. No names of winning racehorses, no news of major catastrophes. Nothing but a personal lament had been sent back. It appeared I would make changes if given the chance to live my life over again. Linda Keating, the woman I would apparently never get over, had taken that chance to restructure her past. We had met in the Renaissance painting section of Harvard University's Fogg Art Museum. This led to a romance, though she might have called it a fling. But a former fiancé vowing to renounce his wavering commitment in a sunny California hometown had conspired against me. Linda had left for good only a few months before this time. 3 days before this time was when I met Dr. Beth Marzik, the woman I would marry according to the message. Her publisher had hired me to shoot the jacket portrait for her book. It was a book about light being particle or wave, so I decided that a shot of the author gazing at a star-filled sky would fit the theme. On a clear night, Dr. Marzik and I went just far enough away from Boston's city lights to catch the stars at their brightest. She was much younger than I'd expected, about my own age. What I noticed first was her long auburn hair. It was a bit frizzy, but the camera and moonlight would fix that. She wore a bulky sweater, one that made sense for the spring chill, but that seemed very casual to appear on her first book. I was loading a third roll of film when I said, "I once heard that if you could rocket to a distant planet in the snap of a finger and look back at Earth with a super telescope, you could watch yourself taking off. That true?" "In theory," she said, "if you got there before the light rays showing the takeoff did." She pulled up the sleeves of her sweater. I readjusted the tripod. "So, traveling at the speed of light and looking back at Earth would give you a still photograph?" Beth's loud laugh startled me. "Yep, and you'd look like a still photograph yourself to everyone on Earth. Basic Einstein. The faster a body passes through space, the slower it appears to pass through time. Moving at the speed of light would make that body stand still, at least relative to Earth time." I snapped the first shot on the new roll, then opened the aperture 1 f-stop. I was a little confused by all she had said, so I asked, "And what if that body moves faster than light?" "Now that's a toughie. Would moving faster than light send a body back in time? Of course, some say that running makes a body feel younger." I peeked at her over my viewfinder. "Humor? From a quantum physicist?" I snapped the shutter again and opened the aperture another setting. Pulling up her sleeves again, she added, "All we know is that matter probably couldn't ever move as fast as light." This idea stuck with me. Maybe matter can't move as fast as light, but could light itself be accelerated just a bit to send it back in time? She interrupted my asking this aloud. "Let's talk about your job now. Why so many pictures? This is your third role." "Difficult lighting conditions. I'm trying a bunch of exposures so we can go with the best one." After a beat, I admitted, "And I guess I'm a bit of a perfectionist. Some would say a compulsive perfectionist. Ah, the difference between art and science. She dropped her pose and faced me directly. Each scientific discovery is always just another step forward, or some say backward. But a piece of art is permanent, so it must be made perfect. Very perceptive. You've given this some thought. I've always had a weakness for art, she said, pulling up her sleeves and resuming her pose. She glanced back at me with a smirk. And artists. Flirtation? From a quantum physicist? Beth had violated the image of a bookish scientist. However, looking at her from a perspective of romance, even in the moonlight, had only evoked a vision of Linda. I did not return the flirtation. After we had said goodnight, the only thoughts that lingered were about sending light back in time. Beth would have to invent the light accelerator, I figured. This device would be worthless, though, unless someone had already set out photosensitive paper to catch the rays being sent back. So I set out the paper that very night on the assumption that I'd still have access to the studio in the future. The next morning, I bought a sensor that would click off a buzzer when light hit it. I set it beside the paper. 3 days passed before that buzzer went off. I gazed at the picture of myself and at the message from that regretful old man. There was nothing to prove it hadn't been done with makeup or trick photography. There was no proof it came from the future because, presumably, Beth takes care of that. Yet the message suggested it was sent without her knowledge. It could only be a personal note to myself. I needed to get out for some air. I left my studio and I wound up walking to the main library. Using their phone books, I looked up how many freelance photographers were in Santa Barbara. If I were to follow Linda there, I would have to get to know my competition, professional as well as personal. Before settling on any schemes to win Linda back, I had to meet with Beth once more at her publisher's office. In the past, I had been hired to shoot bits and pieces of technology by the graphics director there. Ryan Loomis was his name. Ruin Looms was my mental nickname for him whenever I came to see if he'd accept my finished work. He often didn't. When he had, it became swallowed up by pages of text. A portrait for a book jacket was a step up. When I got to Ryan's office, Beth was already there. Her bright smile showed a type of beauty that I had only begun to recognize while developing her portrait. Was it a face I would grow old with? This was one possible path. I marveled at knowing where that path led and being able to choose a new one. Suddenly, I remembered that, for the present, I was supposed to be selling photos. I boasted about how the moonlight and stars were all real, not studio tricks, and about the hours I'd spent in the darkroom to get the exact effect. Ryan scanned each portrait with all the appreciation of a fax machine. Finally, he said, "Very nice, Brent. We could use them if the book were aimed at a general readership. But all this mood. Scientific readers look for credibility. They prefer flat H2O to sparkling water. We can go with the shot Bess University sent over." A crummy faculty photo? I noticed Beth looking at me with a tilted head and bit lip. The photos went back into my case. I muttered the amenities and headed for the door. "Brent, wait for me in the lobby." Beth touched a finger to her lips, then added, "Please? What I mean to say is, I'd like to buy one or two of the pictures, if I could." Waiting for her on an annoyingly orange chair, I pondered my stagnant life. Why shouldn't I go to Santa Barbara? To marry Beth, who I didn't know yet and who would never help me forget Linda? Even if I wasn't able to steal Linda back from her fiancé, the attempt would prevent my regrets of never having tried. That was the moment I decided to go for it. "Brent?" It was Beth. "I'm sorry your pictures weren't accepted. Want to go get some coffee?" Was this the pivotal question that would head us toward a life together? Suddenly, whether or not to have a cup of coffee became a profound decision. Yanking my thoughts back to the present again, I realized she was just being nice. We went to the corner donut shop. Handing the photos across the table, I said, "Take them. I get paid for time and supplies." Beth flipped through the photos. "I think they're great, but they're not really why I wanted to talk to you." She played with a spoon. I meet pretty many single men in my field, scientists mostly. They really do prefer flat H2O. I like sparkling water, though, and real moonlight and stars instead of studio tricks. Well, I noticed you have no wedding ring.
There's another woman, maybe. My interruption sounded more blunt than it should have. I mean, you're very attractive, and otherwise I'd be very interested. But I might be getting back together with someone. She nodded. I nodded. She put more sugar into her coffee and stirred it. We hurt for a change of subject, so I told her about my idea of sending light back through time. Her loud laugh surprised me again.
Most people think about sending themselves through time. That's why I like artists. They see things differently. But unfortunately, light can't be sped up. Its rate of travel is one of the few reliable constants we have.
I pursed my lips. Didn't they used to say that about Earth being at the center of the universe? She laughed again.
After a moment, she whispered, I like you.
When I got back to my darkroom, the buzzer was calling. Apparently, I had done enough to plant the seed of light acceleration in Beth's head. I quickly developed the photo. It was of a bride and groom, and I was the groom. I looked like I was in my late 40s. It took me a moment to recognize Linda at that age. The note was longer this time. I often wonder what became of the Brent who married Beth. No doubt he waited to send back this message until his final years for the same reason I did. By reaching back and making changes, do we wipe out the people we've become? And is that necessarily a bad thing? Like any work of art, you slave over it until you get it right. Life is the ultimate work of art. This photo is about 30 years old, my time, and about 15 years to come, your time. The Santa Barbara trip is successful, eventually. Linda first chooses her other love. That marriage slowly deteriorates. The divorce results from an affair, Linda's and mine. 15 stormy years. What if I had spent some of those years with Beth, but without marrying her? Then if my feelings for Linda remain, I'd be free to move to Santa Barbara when her marriage is about over. In an interview about the light accelerator, Beth mentioned our talk at the donut shop. I contacted her, and it was like we were old friends. She helped me buy back the old studio and lent me an accelerator without too many questions. That's why you're reading this. Beth never finds anyone else. Maybe you can't devote your life to her, but you can give her part of it. After an hour of shifting between that last line and the wedding photo, I looked up Beth's number and called her. She consented to dinner and a movie, though I sensed some confusion about my change of heart. After an hour, the buzzer in the darkroom went off. This time, the regret was never having had children. It would have been unfair to have them with Beth, and it was too late to have them with Linda. Maybe out of exasperation, I decided it was a mistake to marry either one of them. I was still in my 20s. I could meet someone else who would make me happy. Couldn't I? I called Beth again and left a message canceling our plans. My next contact from the future said that my decision to seek someone other than Beth or Linda leads to a life of short-term relationships and ultimate loneliness. So when Beth called back and told me that I had only one chance to stop being a jerk and go out with her, and that it wasn't like she was asking to marry me, I said yes. Apparently, the lonely Brent had said no. The date turned out to be wonderful. I felt very comfortable with Beth. Afterward, though, the buzzer was buzzing again. Being with Beth becomes so comfortable that I marry her. But I never stop loving Linda, right back to where I started. Then came warnings about decisions I hadn't even made yet, such as taking a job as the chief photographer at Beth's university. I started to wonder who I was, or rather, when was me? Was I someone in this moment, or was this just a step toward a future me? And how many optional futures were there? And was there another Brent behind me who was getting multiple exposures of all these messages sent back? Was I just a leaf caught in a white water of possibilities, eddies swirling back, tossing me into other eddies? I needed someone to help me figure it out, but I couldn't ask Beth. I'd already made so many decisions that affected her fate. And the buzzer went off again, like my life was a game show and I kept getting the answer wrong. Bzzz, no, bzzz, sorry, bzzz, that is incorrect. I felt like curling up tight beneath my desk. Instead, I developed the most recent photo. It was of me, but me at about my age and all twisted out of shape. Once I got it to the office lights, I saw that it was a close-up of a tuba player. The brass bell of the instrument reflected a crowd along a sidewalk, parade watchers, no doubt. Prominent among them was myself, holding the camera vertically and revealing half my face. An interesting shot, I guess, but I've never cared for the modern aesthetic that screams, "Look at how I created this! Look at me!" The message said, "The love triangle that keeps screwing things up isn't between you, Linda, and Beth. It's between you, Linda, and Linda's fiancé." This time I ignored Beth, but still waited quite a few years to go after Linda. Without a clear alternative, she surrenders to staying with her husband. But we become confidants, and she told me all about him. His name is Michael Britton, a lawyer, who works too late and maybe cheats on her. In your time, he's still doing paralegal work at a downtown firm. There's a tall parking structure attached to the building. The bottom levels are for shoppers. Local employees park on the upper levels. The message gave more details, and I didn't understand why until it stated, "Remember that urge you had when Linda first explained why she was leaving? You're going to have to do it. You have to kill Michael Britton." I took the photo of the tuba player on Memorial Day a long time ago. It started a lifetime of figuring out how to do the murder. You see, there's a sign in the background for a shop that was 3 years old when I took the shot, but I think it's brand new for you. In other words, it can serve as absolute proof that you were in Boston this upcoming Memorial Day. So there's no way you could have shoved Michael Britton over the railing of that parking structure in Santa Barbara. In an instant, my life had lurched from science fiction to murder mystery. As I reeled from the shift, it struck me that Linda's fiancé had the life I wanted. So long as he lived, I could not be the person who marries Linda first. I began to feel oddly sure that killing this man would make my future life one that ends with no regrets. Thinking the murder through, just toying with the idea, I realized that I couldn't have any records of my flying to Santa Barbara. I could find some excuse for using cash instead of credit to buy the ticket, but check-in at the airport requires a photo ID. Making a fake one is about a 15-minute job for a commercial photographer. Contemplating what false name I might use got me fretting about who I was again. Was I really a murderer? No, I couldn't do it. The next morning, the buzzer was going. This time, my future self said that I had decided against the murder and led yet another miserable life. I pleaded with me to do it. Maybe what makes someone cross that line to actually commit a murder is the vision that so long as the victim lives, there is no chance for happiness. For me, that vision was in sharp focus. Besides, I knew Britton was going to care more about his job than about Linda. Linda was even going to suspect him of cheating on her. I went to work on the fake ID. That Memorial Day weekend, the busy check-in attendant at Logan Airport only glanced at the ID of a man in his late 20s, a man going to Santa Barbara for a few days. His name meant nothing to her. Ryan Einstein. She also never suspected that Mr. Einstein had been in his bathroom vomiting from anxiety shortly before leaving for the airport. My plan was simple. I called Britton's law office from a payphone in Santa Barbara and told him that it was important that I meet with him. I explained that Linda and I had been intimate in Boston, and he needed to know something too personal to mention over the phone. I offered to buy him a drink. Friday evening was the only time I had available, so my lie went, because I was spending the holiday weekend in LA with friends. I suggested a time just late enough to ensure that most everyone else using the parking structure would be gone, having raced home for 3 days off. Britton said he'd be working until after dark and made it even later. I asked about a nearby place to park, and on cue, he mentioned the parking structure. We agreed to meet on the floor he usually parked. It was the fifth floor, certainly high enough. Everything was perfect. That is, until I saw him and realized I couldn't do it. As he came through the garage door, I felt the sting of sweat under my arms and on the back of my neck. My fingers must have gone numb because my portfolio case slapped against the cement floor. Photos of Linda were in it to serve as a lure to get him to the railing above the back alley. I tried to laugh, to blame my nervousness on what I had to tell him. Before I knew it, we were on our way to a bar together. I suppose he could be called handsome. Dark eyebrows, square jaw, that type. He seemed amused that Linda's interim lover was so twitchy. I made it part of my act. Back in Boston, my vomiting just before going to the airport had been triggered by the realization that I had no escape plan if I failed to kill him. Sitting on my bathroom floor, I had devised a fable to cover myself. I told it to Britton once our drinks arrived. The fable was about my having cheated on Linda and the other woman recently telling me that I should go see a doctor. The disease was curable, I assured him, but I was too flustered to tell Linda directly how I had exposed her to it. My anxiety made it easy to stumble while sidestepping the issue of Britton's subsequent exposure.
"Why didn't you just write?" he asked. "And how did you know where I work?"
Well, since I had this trip planned, I figured I should do it in person. I'm not big on writing. And Linda had mentioned the name of the firm once or twice. This last statement wasn't exactly a lie. She just hadn't mentioned it to me yet. There was little else Britton could do but nod. He said,
"She and I go to the same doctor. Maybe when I get myself tested, I could ask if he'd test her without saying too much. Thanks for being honest with me."
He chuckled, shaking his head.
"That whole monogamy thing is a tough row to hoe."
It was then that I stopped being aware of all the witnesses who could place me with Britton at this bar. Instead, I zoomed in on the intended husband of the woman I loved. I ordered another scotch for him and a beer for myself. I asked him to explain what he meant by a tough row to hoe. At first, he only shrugged. By the fourth round, though, we were old pals.
"Linda is wonderful," he said with a slur just starting. "But there's women you marry, and there's women you, well, don't marry. And I love them both."
I didn't join in with his giggling. I silently downed the last of my beer. Then I said, "Come on, I'll walk you back." Once we had gotten to the parking structure, I told him I wanted to see Santa Barbara from the top level. He thought that would be fun. Once we were seven floors up, I had no problem getting him to join me at the back railing. On the plane ride back, I imagined them finding his body in the alley after a day or two. I knew there would be no way to tell if he had fallen, jumped, or been pushed. The next several months, I tried to live as inconspicuously as possible. Every time the phone rang, I jolted and rehearsed my alibi before answering. The only calls were business, though. Beth called, and I used the not-ready-to-see-other-people excuse. I didn't want to grow too comfortable with her. Still, to avoid suspicion, I knew I'd have to wait a long, long time before contacting Linda. I spent a lot of time alone, working and walking, worrying. What I worried most about was why I was not getting any more messages from the future. Had I finally done what it took to lead a life without regrets? Or was I going to be living out my life in a prison cell? I checked and rechecked the buzzer. Occasionally, I developed the paper I had set out just in case. Instead of pictures of my future, there was nothing. One day, I got a call from Beth. She insisted on coming over, assuring me that the reason was light acceleration, not dating. What she had to say must be said in person, not over the phone. As I hung up, I remembered having said something similar to Michael Britton. What was Beth planning? When she arrived, we sat in my living room. She looked pale, her hair disheveled. After turning down my offer of wine, she said, "You got me thinking about like traveling backwards in time. I realized that it might work. The first step would be to set up something that would catch the light waves, and you had mentioned photographs. Last week I got some photographic paper, and I set up a little preliminary experiment for myself. I've changed my mind. I will have some wine."
As I brought back two glasses of Merlot, I couldn't stop my hands from shaking. It had never occurred to me that Beth might send messages back to herself, too. In some of my future paths, we'd gotten married. In others, we didn't. Who among those future Beths sent back messages? The schizophrenia of playing with time was tearing me into shreds again. Beth took a sip of wine. She said, "I got a message from myself, my future self. Turns out we get married." She laughed quietly. Her laugh had never been quiet before. I tried to look casually curious, a raise of my eyebrow, a tilt of my head. She must have gotten a message from some earlier path. The path I was on now was supposed to lead me to marrying Linda. She continued, "At the end of your life, hypertension leads to a fatal heart attack when you reach your mid-50s. Anyway, at the end of your life, you'll make a confession to me. A very scary confession." I swallowed some wine. Something was terribly wrong. I had nothing to confess in those other paths. What would have led me to Beth in this one? "You'll tell me that you had wanted to marry someone named Linda. Is this the woman you mentioned? You'll have contacted her about a year after she leaves you for someone else. But her family is going to tell you she'll have committed suicide."
I heard a buzzer somewhere, but I realized it wasn't real.
"It'll be one of those sympathy suicides, because the man she wanted to marry will have killed himself, or that's how his death will be judged. They'll find his body shortly after he fails the bar exam for a third time, and they'll figure he got drunk and killed himself over that."
Britain had never said anything about failing any exams. My hand squeezed against the wine glass. Instead of shattering, it shot out from the pressure of my fingers. The glass bounced off the coffee table. The wine hung in the air, arching in wobbling shapes. Finally, the red water balloons broke against the table while the cracked glass rolled on the floor. I felt my arm being grabbed, and I pulled away. Beth's hand still reached out as she continued to speak.
"You'll tell me to send a message back in time to you, but you're going to die before you can explain exactly where to place the light accelerator. That's why I got the message. Brent, you're going to confess that you killed this man. Is there anything to this? Are you thinking about killing someone?" The message said that toward the end, you're not coherent enough to give exact dates to anything. For God's sake, Brent, if you kill him, you'll kill the woman you want to marry.
I looked at Beth, but my eyes were so filled with tears that I only saw a blur. I swallowed hard. There was still a buzzing in my ears, and I couldn't quite hear what I was saying. "It's too late. He's dead. Already dead." Now I reached out to her, and she jerked away. After a long silence, she whispered,
"I guess I didn't want to think about that."
I heard myself reciting the alibi word for word, exactly as I had rehearsed it all too often.
"Well, yeah," Beth interrupted. "I know how you got that tuba player's picture. It'll be tough to explain to a jury, but I can try."
She edged toward the front of the couch. "But this guy neglects Linda. He probably cheats on her. I saved her from that. She wouldn't kill herself over him."
Beth edged forward again, shaking her head.
"You're probably confusing the future with the present. Right now, she's in love with him."
She stood up.
"If you don't call the police, I'm going to. One of us has to right away. Finding out the man she loves didn't kill himself might be what'll keep this Linda from taking her own life."
I watched Beth take a few steps in the direction of the front door. I knew she was terrified of me, terrified of what I had become capable of. But all I could think about was the first time I saw Linda. Her beautiful hair, blonde and shoulder length, but with uneven bangs. innocent blue eyes and a nose just a bit too big by some standards. A warm smile with one crooked tooth. All these little imperfections had become fixed and forgotten in the mind's eye of a photographer falling in love. "I'll call the police," I said. "I'll turn myself in." I wiped the tears from my cheeks. The buzzer in my head was just beginning to fade. "You have to do me a favor, though, with the light accelerator." She took two steps backward. "Oh, no, absolutely not. I'm not going to invent it. Look what it leads to. Mortals fiddling with the powers of the gods. This is something straight out of Greek tragedy. And all because of something I do? No." I clamped my eyes shut. "Then just think about what I have to say." I can still taste the vomit despite all the rinsing. Coming out of the bathroom, I tell myself that the fable about the other woman giving me some disease might sound shaky, but Britain won't really question it with me right there. I grab my portfolio case to check yet again for the pictures of Linda. I hear something. I take a few steps back toward the darkroom, and sure enough, it's the buzzer. I glance at the clock and decide that there's just enough time to develop this picture and still get to the airport before my plane takes off. It might be something important, I tell myself. You have just heard Plotting for Perfection by Tim Prossel, read by Tim Prossel. Copyright by, well, yes, Tim Prossel. If you're interested in my other writing projects, short stories, and audio plays, please visit my blog. It's at timprossel, all one word, TimProsil.wordpress, all one word, .com. Thank you.